Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and coming at you live from the last Blockbuster is Michael Kester.
Yeah. I'm the last poor man in San Francisco at the last block.
Oh, no.
You know, funny story about that, and it's actually relevant to what I know you want to jump into. Knives Out and 8 Women today. Thank you.
Nailed it.
I live down the street from literally the last video store in San Francisco, and I recently discovered that the distributor for The Last Black Man in San Francisco did a fundraiser for The Last Video Store in San Francisco.
Beautiful.
By giving them the initial access to the movie.
Yeah.
So it's literally like 4 blocks from me, this place. And anyway, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you are not actually at the last Blockbuster. Not that anybody cares.
Yeah, is that in Portland?
I think so. There's a documentary about it. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, Brad, our friend Brad.
Sure.
He went to the last Blockbuster.
Patreon.com/double feature.
He went to the...
If you're our friend Brad.
He went to the last Blockbuster in Texas before that shit shut down and did like a little like documentary about it with his friends.
Oh my God. All right. I already want to talk about this. So patreon.com/double feature. That's where we met Brad. He's on the Patreon. Brad is a guy. He's on the Patreon. Now he's our friend, Brad. Come be our friend. Patreon.com/double feature. We are, am I going to have some rallying cries on our show, but, I'm always trying to stick my neck out for the show first, you know? I feel like that's number one priority, make sure the show doesn't die, because then all this other stuff we're evangelizing, I mean, who knows what happens? There's no show, I don't know. Patreon.com/double feature, it's how we keep our voices on the air, we keep the podcast going, and keep talking about this film community stuff. Here is something that kind of deserves its own additional content episode. So we'll keep it kind of brief. But you mentioned the movies for today. 8 Women, I know, is hard to find.
It's not just hard to find.
Yeah. Well, this is, this is true of a lot of the foreign films we do. We do them anyways.
Sure.
In hopes that people will, I don't know, rent a Blu-ray or I don't know how people are finding movies, but I am.
People order them 2 weeks in advance on Amazon.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, we have a coalition that's around the world. It's a small group of people on that there, Patreon, but they do come from all over the world. So I do know people are listening in other countries. And sometimes, you know, they have things like the BFI in Britain that archives film, important film, and people can go there. You can go hang out at the BFI. You can watch films at the BFI. It's a preservation society among so many other things. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit in America because we are approaching a crisis level with some of this stuff. I had mentioned last episode, there's an article by Kate Hagen that talks about this a lot more in depth. I'll just give you some of the highlights. It's on our website, doublefeature.fm, under this episode. But you can probably look it up. It's In Search of the Last Great Video Store, a Directory. And the long and short of it is that Kate Hagen's trying to put together a list of all the remaining video stores in the country and really, I think, in the world. So we know things like Blockbuster are dying. We know that video stores are going out the window. But the reason to be alarmed about this, I have long been a proponent of digital, and in some ways I still am, but I feel like if you care about film, movies are vanishing.
Mm-hmm.
They are becoming hard to see, and more, if somebody tells you to see a movie, what's going to determine if you actually go do that is if it's on a streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
We got to just start buying these things.
Yeah.
In physical fucking copies.
I know.
I mean, it's a crazy idea for me to say.
I wish one of the two hosts had been doing that for years. I just,
Look, I'm not emotionally prepared to be like, yo, you're right.
I'm not. I'm fucking shocked.
Because I have I have my digital film collection. And aside from the very, very much missing extras, I like it. But new films are not coming out. You know, I love the movie Cam. I can't buy it on iTunes. In fact, iTunes doesn't even exist. But there's like a weird equivalent. And it's even becoming hard to get to. So the idea of digital ownership is going out the window. And rather than try to hold the torch for something that doesn't even love itself, I just think we gotta buy physical copies, guys. It's time to get back in the bunker. Here's the thing that really made me crazy about this. If you want to find out where to watch a movie, Apple TV's got a thing. You can just ask Siri. Maybe it'll find it. The real way to do your research is justwatch.com, right? You go in there, it tells you what platforms have this available. So Kate wrote in this article that Just Watch, I think 140 of the top streaming platforms, says that in the entire index of all of those streaming platforms, there are only 85,000 films available in total. Every single channel combined. When you compare that to the size of a video store, she uses Scarecrow Video in the article. It's one of the larger, maybe the last largest remaining video store in the world.
Let me just interject a quick thing here.
Yeah.
Just so people can understand. So you're saying 85,000 films. For the record, our podcast has done greater than 1% of that number of movies. We've done over... well over 1,000 movies, probably almost 2,000 movies on just double feature, okay?
Yeah.
85,000 is a big number when you're thinking about like winning on Wheel of Fortune, but it is a small number when you're thinking of watching two movies a week.
I mean, the Scarecrow Video number is the one that's eye-opening to me because it's a large video store. It has a big collection, but its collection is 160,000 titles. Compare that to every online streaming service combined. I mean, if we were to compare every video store during its heyday, you know, this is one fucking video store, 160,000 titles. Netflix alone is something like 3,000 or 4,000 titles. People don't realize this. There's less than 4,000 movies on Netflix. You think, oh, a movie, I wonder if it's on Netflix. It's not. It's not on Netflix. Less than 4,000 movies are on Netflix. And something she doesn't even talk about in the article that really worries me as a former Silicon Valley inhabitant, and actually a Hollywood inhabitant, is the end game for all of these services, Disney Plus, whatever the fucking Peacock thing is, Paramount, Max, the end game for all of them is to have a catalog that's 100% content they own outright and don't license, which is the death of indie film. So these different companies, they choose what you watch. You know, they choose what they're going to put on without curation. You know, it's really just like corporate curation. They decide these are the films that are going to be available. And she uses this great example in her article about how during the Black Lives Matter protests, one might have thought, oh, there's a Kathryn Bigelow film, Strange Days. This might be very intriguing for an audience to consider how 90s genre filmmaking, you know, reacted to Rodney King in the wake of these new Black Lives Matter protests. You can't see it. Not available on streaming. There's no way for you to stream that title. And the idea to me that there are films, huge film, that Catherine fucking Bigelow's Strange Days, like that's a movie people know. This is not an obscure title. I'm not asking people to watch Eight Women, the French film that's like Knives Out, but people are watching Knives Out instead. Strange Days, and you can't get it. And this is going to happen more and more with old film. Harvey Weinstein is the sole rights owner of Dogma, Kevin Smith's Dogma. I mean, it's just, it's vanished forever. You can't see it. We did a fucking show on it. Like, people could just go to their local store and grab it. And it's making me crazy. So... you know, video stores are not just places to rent movies. They are historical preservation. And this really deserves an additional content because I don't want to waste all of our Knives Out women time on this. But man, this is just happening more and more, where we program stuff on the show and then it disappears from all streaming or was never on there anyways, and nobody can get to it, and it's a real fucking problem. What people can watch is Knives Out. People have at least seen Knives Out, so let's start with the log line on that. See if you can bring me out of this depressed apocalyptic mood of mine here.
Knives Out is about a wealthy man with a lot of family who dies under mysterious circumstances. And it's about the Southern Fried detective getting to the bottom of who done it.
Is the Southern Fried element of the detective what inspired the Crispies in your Agatha Crispies?
No. Because the Agatha Crispie is, I don't know if you, nobody will know this, but Agatha Crispies is the cereal that Tiny Firefly is eating in House of 1,000 Corpses when he comes downstairs and the girls are chained up.
Oh my God. I don't know if it makes it better or worse that it's an obscure Rob Zombie reference.
He pours himself a bowl of Agatha Crispies.
Yeah, well, I think in describing this, the really alluring elements to me are, all right, so it's like an Agatha Christie thing. So, you know, they really help paint. The big fucking standout to me is just like what you can do if you have a huge film and it's not just a bunch of people wearing capes, you know? If we took all the cape money and the chasing orbs money and we put it into this other original property. So you have something that top to bottom is done in a way that is marketing friendly. It is ready to bring people in. And we see that right away just in the log line. They accomplish this thing of having an additional meta layer where Christopher Plummer's character, his empire, it's not just that he has an empire, he has a lot of money, there's wealth, but his empire is basically that he is Agatha Christie. He writes novels like this. And so right away, it's already impressive to me that the movie fucking gets away with this level of like, imagine if I was just like, oh, we'll do kind of an Agatha Christie thing, okay? So it's going to be when this rich guy dies under mysterious circumstances, what's the phrase they use? Charming gentleman detective or whatever the fuck is.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Old school detective suspects foul play by, you know, his family coming for the inheritance.
CSI KFC.
And when you say, oh, okay. Hey, where did he make all his money? I'm like, writing books. You're like, a little too close to Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yes, those are the books he wrote. Exactly those books. Actually, lean the fuck in.
Listen, this movie it's as if Rian Johnson was like, I'm going to make a film that prints sold movie tickets. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
It's a base level whodunit with the biggest cast you've seen in 2 years, all playing characters out of type.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be fun and easy, and it's going to keep you guessing. It's going to be everything you wanted from the El Royale that film didn't deliver.
Poor evening at the El Royale needs to get its proper time. What was the fucking name of that movie?
Bad Times.
Bad Times at the
El Royale.
Come on. El Royale. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If you had asked me to just come up with, okay, well, fine, stop complaining about superhero movies. We'll give you your whole A-list cast, just whatever. Who do you want? Name 12 people that you want.
Mm-hmm.
I'd run out after three, and I probably wouldn't have hit anybody in this movie except to go, I don't know, Chris Evans.
Yeah.
Do like Chris Evans. So the movie, it's as if it's done a better job of even combing the A-list that I could do in theory on my best A-list possible dream cast for a project. Gets them, they come on, they all play, you know, weird characters in their own different directions. And that's just like right in the cast. I mean, I feel like that's some of the obvious stuff, but the production design, everything is just A-level execution. It's like what a film looks like when you have proper money to do something correctly.
Yeah.
And you hire people who are really good to do that thing.
It's really interesting when you put it that way, because I think that is the piece of this puzzle that really a lot of folks don't understand about Knives Out is that when you think of Knives Out, you think of this fucking baseline box office hit that everybody fucking loves. Literally nobody didn't like this movie on earth. And it was nominated really for like best picture or some shit. And, you know, it's literally just like, it's this movie that's just like, here's a movie everybody unanimously agrees is good. There's just no wiggle room. And the thing that's amazing about it is that it's an original property. It's not fucking Star Wars 11. It's not based in the same universe as Fast and Furious. Mm-hmm. It's its own original property. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that this movie is that good and that beloved is because for one time out of 1,000, somebody took an original script and went, put blockbuster firepower behind this. Every movie, you and I just talked about, actually two films last week, but you know, a film like blew my mind last week, tiny indie art house movie, you know, the movies we do every other time on Double Feature, right? If they had $100 million firepower, think about how many more popular movies there would be that didn't have capes or fucking the Death Star.
Well, I mean, this episode of Double Feature talks about it right here. You know, we have, if there's ever been an episode that's like verging on these films are too similar, you know, Eight Women is basically like, hey, everybody, Knives Out came out in France years earlier. No one's heard of it. No one saw it. And still today, you can't fucking find it anywhere. And it's not even old. It's not like, oh, a classic old inspiration. Like if you watch these two movies back to back, you'll be fucking aghast at how similar they are. And they both draw inspiration from, you know, I mean, we've name dropped Agatha Christie 100 million times. If you don't know Agatha Christie, I mean, the first thing I would cite is the often renamed And Then There Were None.
Sure.
Let's just stick with and Then There Were None. That's all at you. Wiki that at your own discretion. But Agatha Christie has this same sort of feeling to me. You ever read an Agatha Christie novel?
Yes, I've read And Then There Were None.
Yeah, so it's like...
But it had a different name. Yeah.
I don't know what the... like, it's pulpy, but it is also like, you know...
Oh, yeah.
Read in one sitting, can't put it down, just like gripping
his spot. I will tell you...
I mean, it's magic in a bottle.
I'll tell you, the thing about Agatha Christie... The thing about a nice bowl of Agatha Crispies is not that it's a mystery wrapped in an enigma.
Nutritious.
But it's part of this balanced breakfast.
Right.
It's not that it's this complex mystery wrapped in an enigma.
It's the cocaine part of the magic breakfast.
It's the fact that it's exactly what I'm saying. It's actually both of these movies. You're right. It's just, you know, it's so digestible. It's not that it's not challenging in that you can easily guess what's going on.
Well, it's also based around a plot puzzle, which
that's
is the
thing,
most,
right?
Like,
is the movie, much like the films that you and I love to talk about but never cover on the show, it doesn't have anything to do with anything that's not on the screen. And I think, or, you know, on the page, whatever. Mm. It's, you're not being forced to think outside of what's being handed to you. It's literally you're watching in this case a film, you're examining clues, and the game, the reason that you're an idiot for liking it, is that the movie doesn't want you to know how it ends. So, of course, you're sitting there examining clues, thinking, Lakeith Stanfield's looking kind of weird over there. And the reality is, Rian Johnson...
Shout out to the best actor of all actors, Lakeith Stanfield, who is my number one, I will see anything this man is in right now. Like, literally anything.
Rian Johnson... He wrote this movie so that you don't know how it, I mean, that's the point, right?
Right.
The point of And Then There Were None, the point of Eight Women, the point of Knives Out is that you're not supposed to be able to guess the ending. You're supposed to feel like you can, but the movie is intentionally only giving you the trail of breadcrumbs as it wants you to have them. Yeah, all the answers are not in front of you at the beginning, and you can't know. But for some reason, you think you're smarter than the movie and you think you're going to pull off Michael Shannon's mask and it's actually going to be fucking, I don't know, Michael Shannon still.
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of precedent for this in, I mean, somebody could point to like Murder at the Orient Express or some of these movies that are coming back now and then, or I think you see enough things that are inspired by, and then there were none. I mean, and then there were none is the fucking template for half the horror movies we talk about. It's sort of like the like the basic template slasher plot is just a dumb mysteryless version of And Then There Were None. It's sort of like default. If you're making a horror movie, you have to deviate from that.
Sure.
That is the kill all the people and then get to the bottom of whatever the fuck is going on.
Get to the bottom of why they're standing in a circle.
Ah, there it is. The film circle. I wasn't going to call it out, but yes. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. It's kind of funny to give this movie so much. It's like credit and flack at the same time. Because despite us watching it in the very context of it being derivative, right? That's like the theme of the show today is things that are derivative of Agatha Christie. It also feels like among the big budget films, the freshest thing that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, the freshest thing being released. I'm like, oh, let's see Knives Out, an original property, an original script.
It's the thing that it's ripping off isn't already a sequel. That's the only difference.
Yeah, right. Right.
Every other big budget thing is like it's like a ripoff of a sequel that was remade.
Yeah.
And Knives Out is just like, I'm just ripping off one thing. It's not me being like a spinoff of the reboot of that thing from 1976.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it does a really good job of setting the sort of tone and the sort of like invitation to, it's a love letter. It's the best example of a love letter. It is clearly somebody who goes, you know, it'd be a good time. Why don't we all just settle down for a second, put on our fucking draft house party sweater and take a trip through this Victorian inspired mansion to have a bit of a murder mystery. You and I have been talking about this for the longest time on these like rainy mansion films, these rainy old Clue type movies. I mean, this is 100% a feeling that I'm always interested in something that captures it. It feels like being transported to another world. You have a little project while you're there. You got to solve this mystery. And I chase this all the time. And it's mostly old films that do it. And, you know, I don't know. There's something that for as much as Knives Out is like, oh, it was inspired by this. It did this. It's like this other film. It's, you know, whatever people might say about it in that regard. The execution is extremely fresh. The specific original plot and ideas are fresh. And in some way, just having the power and drive to make this film right now is what's fresh about it.
Yeah.
That Rian Johnson was like, oh, somebody's going to do something I want to do. Hey, guys, we're doing this.
Well, I think also one of the things that the movie does, this is a subtle thing, but I think that one of the things the movie does, maybe even inadvertently, and correct me if you think this is intentional, but it goes, I'm the Star Wars guy. And I'm going to take Captain America and Laurie Strode and put them in something that's not that for the first time in 50 years. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just like just the fact that Chris Evans is in this movie and isn't Captain America makes this feel like a phenomenon.
Right. Right.
It feels like it's coming from a place that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of depressing really to think about. I'm trying not to.
No, it's just amazing.
Okay, just amazing as well.
Don't be depressed because the other movie has singing, so you can't go down now.
Oh man. Yeah, I watched the fuck out of this when this came out. This was a number one go to theaters, see it kind of movie, which I would do again in a heartbeat. I remember Rian Johnson put out a commentary track, which I still haven't heard, but he put it out while it was in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was you download this MP3, take it with you, pop in AirPods, and listen to his commentary while in the theater.
That's the closest thing to William Castle we've had in 100 years.
I know. It's crazy. Our show spends so much time talking about really independent films, the place where I think all the creativity is, is, you know, these smaller projects that can take big swings, be ambitious, mm-hmm. do crazy things, do stuff that people don't want to see, really challenge us. So we talk about a lot of small films. I feel like Rian Johnson, and it's a totally different look and feel than we ever get. He is what it looks like to have large budgets, make commercial movies, and to still take risks.
Yeah, well, there's a few.
And it looks a lot different than I'm used to.
There's a few, there's maybe five directors working in big time Hollywood that are, there's sort of, you know, there's blockbuster by committee, right? And that's what you and I usually decry as these, mm-hmm. these blockbuster movies that essentially become cookie cutter because they have to please enough people. And, you know, you have the one guy, Quentin Tarantino, who can, quote, do whatever he wants with whatever budget he can possibly, you know, any, he can do anything. But those movies are kind
of... Is this you apologizing for your Tarantino slander last episode? Are we trying to get back in the good graces?
No, definitely not. But my point is you have your Rian Johnsons, your Edgar Wrights, your James Gunns, who are these alternative directors mm-hmm. who have inexplicably been given carte blanche to make these massive movies without, you know, without oversight. You know, one of the things that these directors say all the time is that, you know, people will be like, what's your dream project? And they're like, the ones I do, nobody ever tells me what to do. For some reason, it's like people forget that these guys are making movies with the fucking faucet turned on, just spraying money.
Well, that's what's crazy. You know, there's like scene after scene in this movie that I feel like they're big swings. I mean, a lot of them I don't like, frankly. I love Knives Out. Like you said, everybody loves Knives Out. I'd fucking turn around and watch it again right now. It also contains the immigration argument scene, which is maybe my least favorite scene in cinema history, bar none. I just like every group of five people who barely like each other in a room have had this fucking conversation. I hate it. And it's just stuff like that, that it shows up and I'm like, this is better for him having put that, you know, his Star Wars is infamous for this, right? It's just like mm-hmm. dubious, big swings. And you just don't forget these scenes. I mean, I feel like part of explaining what I think is so good about Knives Out is explaining why I think it's good for people to make huge dubious choices that I maybe not even don't like, but like fucking hate.
Yeah, I love when instead of people risking tens of thousands of dollars to make a choice in a film, they're risking millions to just do this thing.
Sure. Well, that makes it just funnier too, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to throw up when she tells a lie.
Every time. Sure, fuck
bold
it.
Bold choice, man.
Fuck it.
Bold. I guess we'll just hope the movie still works once we do that scene.
It's an episode of Twilight Zone now.
I guess we're there, yeah. All right. Eight Women.
I brought you this movie by mistake.
You did.
This movie is on my, this article I wrote like, I don't know, when I was 15. I don't know how old I was. Pre-COVID. So a different person wrote this article, 12 Films of Alternative Christmas on Medium.
Yeah.
And it's just a list of, you know, it's a list of movies that take place on or around Christmas, have Christmas directly involved in the film, but are not the, it's not the standard Christmas movies. And also, you know, like Die Hard, I think has become the quintessential alt Christmas film, but I feel like there's sort of a deeper way to go. You know, like I talked about in that article, just like P2, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and one of the movies that I actually discovered the year I wrote the article was Eight Women.
I know what you mean, man. People are out there having diehard conversations. I'm like, yeah, Eight Women is a fucking Christmas film, and you won't tell. People are like, what are you talking about? I'm like, oh, I see. Yeah. I'll show myself out.
People are like, you know what my favorite Christmas movie is? With a smirk. It's Die Hard, man.
Gremlins.
And I'm like, yeah, sure. That's like everybody. It's everybody between the ages of 40 and 25's favorite Christmas movie. Like your grandma liked It's a Wonderful Life.
All right. Well, we've tried to appeal to obscurity here. I don't know if that's the best appeal. I'll say straight off the bat before we start spoiling the fuck out of this, or if we do, I guess, that if you like Knives Out, and you wish you could see it again for the first time, watch Eight Women. that is my call for this. People know what Knives Out is. You like that feeling. You want to be back in that mystery. It's not the same movie. It's very weird and different and French, and we'll talk about all that stuff. But if Knives Out hit a spot for you and you're chasing that high, God, I wish people could find this film easier. Because, it's also like, it's also a great effort, kind of expensive in a weird way. You know, it's like not a tiny art fuck movie. When I saw this, I had seen it in the context of having just gone through this year of trying to watch, you know, the top like 200 French language films. So, yeah, a lot of that stuff is new wave and in the 60s and whatever, but a lot of it is recent. And there's, this doesn't need to turn into a whole French cinema ordeal here, but there's a good handful of actors that if you watch all of the top French language films from the last, even let's say 10 years, or 20, 30 years, you will see these actors again and again. We just talked about Isabelle on the L and Piano Teacher show, you know. We have watched Donkey Skin on this show. Our show isn't terribly heavy. We haven't done a stop down to do a journey or anything, but we've covered some of these and we see these actors. So I was going around watching all of these French language films. I finally worked my way down from, you know, like most to least popular, worked my way down to where Eight Women is. And I have to tell you, like the feeling, it was a magic time. The feeling that I got, it was like watching the fucking Avengers assemble.
Sure.
Where the eight women show up and I'm like, oh fuck, I know them all. If
it's just like Knives Out to the American audience.
And for the movie to also be a Francois Ozon film, I don't think we've done any of his stuff on the show, but he did Young and Beautiful. He did Swimming Pool. I don't know if you've seen Swimming Pool. That's a pretty big one.
Sounds familiar, but I don't think so.
In the House, Double Lovers on Shudder, or was on, I don't know when the fuck you're listening to this, but that was on Shudder. So he's, you know, in his own way, a provocative French director, does movies that kind of flick you behind the ear a little bit. You know, they provoke in a certain kind of way that actually isn't easy even for us, I think, to put our finger on it when we think about like provocative directors. Do you know what I mean about that when you say, okay, so like Eight Women, like something's provocative about this movie, right? Like something's kind of like,
definitely
fuck you audience about it. Yeah, and it's hard to really say what it is. It's like the experience of watching it is sort of,
I mean,
like,
it's just a cheeky movie. It's a cheeky movie. It's a movie that very much has a handle on, This is actually something I think it has different than Knives Out, because Knives Out is going, I'm going to do the Agatha Christie thing and I'm just going to hit that nail right on the fucking head for 2.5 hours or 11 hours or that movie's long as fuck. But Eight Women goes, so there's this thing, it's the Agatha Christie thing. We're going to make fun of that. That's the difference. That's the difference.
Yeah, well, it is like satirical, or so cheeky was sort of a funny word for it. I mean, that is kind of the...
Yeah.
You can see it a lot. You know where I see it the most? Should we do a log line? All right, it's whatever the log line was from Knives Out. It's that.
Yeah, there's eight women and murder most foul, and nobody leaves until we find out who murdered the most fouls.
Well, hold on. There's seven women. When a murder most foul happens, an eighth woman comes out from like under a bush or something, and now she's there.
Sure.
And that's the movie. Yeah.
Right.
So we have to figure out, you know, no one can leave the house till we figure out who committed the murder. And also there's musical.
Everybody has a musical number. It, well, but it's, so this is actually sort of a distinction I want to make. This has to be said when the musical gets brought up. So, you know, anything you read about Eight Women says that it's like a musical comedy or a musical mystery or whatever. Maybe it's just me, but I don't feel like I would ever categorize this movie as a musical, because the musical numbers, literally, there are eight of them. There are one per woman. Each woman has a song. And it's less like a musical where, you know, like songs move the plot along, and more like, it's more like a mixtape
I would argue that no new information ever comes out in a song or even information period.
That's what I mean.
Transpires.
I feel like it's just, it's like a mixtape. And instead of being like the music is integrated into the film, it's almost like the music just kind of goes, this is this woman. She sings this song. And that's just like.
Well, and every song is sort of like, the lyrics are like more or less. who among us can say? End of song. And you're like, what was that even about? You know, men. They, I don't know, maybe they're sad or they got troubles. I feel like that is even more of a plot. If you sat down with any of the songwriters and went, what is this song about? What happens in it? Is it a metaphor? What are we singing about? Like, well, I don't know. You know, times, sometimes you just feel like, and then you do a song or whatever. That is not information. That is not nothing. No stories are being told. Nothing is being conveyed. Everything is sort of like sometimes it's heads, sometimes it's tails. I think that's literally the name of a fucking song in this. I don't know if I made it up. I can't keep track anymore, but that's basically about the songs. But then like, I think that the lowest key element of comedy to this is the editing. I think the editing is so fucking funny. You're watching these people sort of ad-lib songs or plot, which I don't think they are, which makes it even funnier, but it sort of seems like they're ad-libbing the songs. That's about how they're written. But also the dances to the songs are just sort of like, as if the direction was sort of like, okay, you don't know how to dance. Wow, I don't believe you're the, wow, this is the fifth music number and you're the fifth woman who doesn't know how to dance. Okay, all right, well, what's worked for us really well so far, which is to say not at all, is why don't you turn to the left and then the right, and I want you to touch your nose and then the doorknob and then the curtain and then your nose again. That's a dance. And so you just sort of, like the person singing will sort of wander out and like wave their hand and then do like a Marilyn Monroe wave or something, or a Jackie O wave, right?
The rest of the cast is like, I guess I'll back you up.
The expression on everyone else's face when the person's singing, oh my God, I'm losing it, is seriously like, that's the expression. And I love the moments in the edit where it will cut to someone and it's like a live edit, you know, it's like you're watching a band on like SNL or a late night or something, and they accidentally cut to a person like during the keyboard solo, they cut to the bass player is not doing anything, you know, that's sort of how the edits work. So someone will be dancing, they'll be singing, and they'll be like, well, there's two women in the room. I don't know, cut to the other one. And she'll just sort of be staring off to the side, like waiting for the song to finish. Or there's an edit in the, somewhere in the middle of the movie that just stays on the woman's face for like 8 seconds too long at the end of the scene. It just destroys me. And look, I don't know what it's saying. I don't understand. Like, for having seen all this French cinema, I feel no better equipped to go, like, yeah, this is a really French kind of sense of humor. Because I haven't seen a lot of French comedies, especially recent ones. You know, most of the French comedies I've seen are really old. So I can't, I can't like, oh yeah, this is like a French style joke. The French stuff I see in this is sort of like character development. You know, it's a lot more, every character has a weird arc.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. And that's a little different than Knives Out.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the fucking, I just assume half of this stuff is humor and not just the director being a weirdo.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little of both. And then, you know, there's also like the beauty of it being foreign. And so you just cock your head because you're not in on the joke.
Well, we just saw that on like Pieta. And anytime we watch a foreign film, there's always some element of like, this is just so weird because they're in another country and a lot of this is alien. But there is stuff you see with intent. You know, like there's two fights in this that have like the same fucking choreography, you know, like the two younger girls fighting and then the two older women have a fight scene. And it's literally the same, like pin each other down, pull the hair, do a bite on the wrist as if they couldn't spring for a second set of fight choreography. So they're just like, I don't know, that last one was fine. Do that again. And then there's stuff that's really subtle about it. There's sort of the under the surface, like the mockery of traditional values in this movie. where everyone clutches their pearls. And then by the end, it's basically just an orgy.
Right.
So everybody's character sort of, or a lot of the characters start as being like really, whatever the opposite of progressive is, you know, like these just really shaming sex and fucking homophobic. And, you know, the number of times somebody calls somebody else a slut, it's just ridiculous. And by the end of the movie, everybody's story twist is sort of like, oh, well, I was sleeping with all of these people. We were sleeping together. Now you and I can sleep together. They protest being called promiscuous. And they also do it for like 2 seconds, which I love all the arguments in this film. It's sort of like, oh, I can't believe you're such a slut. And the person will defend themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, how dare you say that about it? And then take a drag off the cigarette and be like, yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? All of the dialogue, the kind of, it's hard to find a way to put this, but like the casual mortal wounding of the insults.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they cut so deep. Like, they're so unnecessarily vicious.
It feels like the conversational level of a movie, like Metropolitan, but with like whimsy, as opposed to like actual like scathing assaults.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's treated so, like everything else in this movie, so flippantly.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just throw out, and these are people who all have relative familiarity with each other. You know, they're related. It's all family dynamics like the previous film, but they will just cut to the bone immediately. And that's one of those things that makes me feel like it's almost a mockery of French cinema, just in the way you think of like how people talk to each other. And everything is story-driven, character-driven, cut to the emotions. You know, the turn of phrases are just so much more like immediate and deep. Oh, love 8 Women. Did we do our job? We got a log line. We did some themes or something. Okay.
Yeah,
we,
you know.
Oh, Jesus.
Nobody can see it anyway.
All right. Justwatch.com. That's a website where you can figure out if the movies we're talking about, you can even fucking see. You know, really, to be honest, like this sort of happened by accident. I wasn't aware that I'm the only person with a copy of this movie, so I apologize. Find this. If you have to buy this fucking movie on Amazon and then pawn it on eBay when you're done, if that's how we watch movies now, I don't know. Just watch 8 Women. It's great. Kate Hagen has that article, In Search of the Last Great Video Store. On it, she has a crowdsourced directory of all the video stores. These are places where you can watch a film because the movie is good and not because Netflix bought it as part of a package deal where they picked up 20 movies for the price of 3 movies from some distributor. It's really the way we should be doing this. Go out, find about movies, build a list, figure out what you want to watch, and go get these fucking movies.
We have a website, doublefeature.fm. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/doublefeature. That's where you can go to, not next week, but maybe the week after that, pick a movie. Do you have producers for this one?
Charles Crawford, Ben Ecker, Ross Mahler, and Joachim Vernon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks to you guys, we get to reassess this year's journey next week, where we're going to talk about another stop-motion movie and another Studio Ghibli movie. These two movies are extremely available to stream, so I don't know. I guess Eric wants you to go not do that. So it's going to be Corpse Bride and Tales from Earthsea.
And we're not totally done with the journey yet. This is, I think, our second to last one, right?
Oh, no. Trust me. Yeah, the last one. You'll know when it's the last one.
Okay.
Corpse Bride, Tales from Earthsea. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.